This is Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. This week, two stories of women who defied limits in male-dominated worlds of extreme adventure. First, Bridget Crocker joins us to talk about her memoir, River's Daughter. From a near drowning as a child on Wyoming Snake River, to becoming a pioneering river guide in an industry dominated by men, Crocker tells a story of resilience, survival, and transformation. Then we revisit our March conversation with Cassidy Randall about her book, 30 Below. It tells the story of the historic 1970 first all-women's ascent of Denali. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. Bridget Crocker talks to rivers, and they talk back. From the day in childhood when a river's advice saved her life to her career as one of the first professional female rafting guides, rivers have been her source of wisdom and inspiration. In her memoir, River's Daughter, Crocker explores themes of recovery from multi-generational cycles of trauma, as well as sexism and racism in the outdoor adventure industry. Crocker is a whitewater explorer and river guide, and she leads women's empowerment river workshops. Bridget Crocker, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
I really love this book, River's Daughter. It's so compelling. I mean, it is a story of tremendous resilience and overcoming a lot of adversity through your connection with nature and your work. Your memoir begins with a powerful childhood experience on the Snake River when you were 9 years old. You fell into a very swift and cold river, and you heard a voice. Tell us what happened and how that initial encounter with a river shaped your relationship to rivers from then on.
Well, I had the great fortune of being raised in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and I was raised in a trailer park just south of town that was situated on the banks of the Snake River. And so I would spend a lot of my free time in this beautiful cottonwood forest that I like to think of as my cottonwood forest. It was my secret spot and where I would go to just feel nurtured and feel that I had some respite. And I could just kind of, you know, lay down the burdens of my childhood and just be a kid in a cottonwood forest. And in spending so much time there, and I spent a lot of time there on my own, but I also had a friend who lived in the trailer park, and we would go there and spend time together and build forts and try to catch frogs and water skippers. I, you know, had spent a lot of time there on my own, just disappearing into the river, you know, the shore. And I heard this interview with Jane Goodall recently where she talked about, you know, when she's taking people into the forest, she really doesn't have as much of a connection or an experience on her own because she's so worried about, you know, getting people into the forest and connecting them. But when she's in the forest alone, she has the experience of just losing herself and kind of becoming the forest. And I had that similar experience as a child growing up in this cottonwood forest where I could just disappear into the bank and become my surroundings. And in that intense, it's like a meditative state. It's a hyper-focus. In that state, I was able to communicate with the river, just in the same way that people are able to communicate with their pets or with, you know, trees. If you really focus, you can kind of, there's a sense and a feeling where you're getting, you know, an energy exchange. And so in that, I learned how to lean into that and strengthen that connection. And often I would hear a voice from the river and it would, you know, be talking to me and comforting me. So the scene that you bring up is, you know, where Justin, my friend Justin and I are playing on this fallen cottonwood tree that was downed all alongside this cut bank, which is a steep, you know, kind of it's caved into the river. And so it's a very steep, precipitous fall. So we were practicing being gymnasts on this cottonwood log and kind of pretending that we were doing these great routines and, you know, always kind of falling onto shore when we would fall off the log. Eventually I fell into the river, off the cut bank and into the river. And my friend leaned out to grab my hand and help me. We were thinking he would pull me to shore and pull me back up. But what ended up happening was the river was so strong, it was a spring runoff. And so everything was melting. And he grabbed my hand and I pulled him into the river. So we were both in the river, just being flushed downstream. And it was so cold, it just takes your breath away, that kind of water, you know, where you just can't think. And I heard a voice yell, "Swim." And I, you know, started swimming and Justin started swimming. And when we made it to shore, I said, "I'm so glad that you yelled to swim, because I was so cold, I forgot." And he said, I didn't yell. And, you know, we looked around, there was no one there. He didn't hear a voice. And, you know, I realized that it was the river who had told me to swim and had saved our lives. And in that moment, I'd been told my whole life by my mother that if I wasn't allowed to be in the water at all, obviously, as most mothers tell their kids, like, don't play in the river, you know, they want to keep you from drowning and keep you safe. And so my mother's line was like, if you fall in the river, you will die. She said that all the time. And so that was kind of hardwired into my brain of, if you fall in, you're going to die. So I'd fallen in and I'd been dragged a fair distance and I didn't die. So in that moment, I realized a couple of things. One, I decided that the river must have a fondness for me and kept me from dying, didn't take my life, spared my life, because, you know, maybe I was a very lucky and special person and the river was choosing me in that way. And also that my mother didn't know everything, you know, that the things that my mother was telling me, maybe some of them weren't true. So I stopped listening to my mother when she talked about the river after that and decided that I knew the river better than she did and would just kind of go off my own instincts when it came to the river from then on.
Now, I imagine people listening to this are thinking, wow, what do you mean that the river spoke to you? And I'm going to pick that up just a little bit later, because it wasn't the only river that spoke to you in this book. But first, a little bit of a background. As you say, you spent your childhood, well, your younger childhood, on the banks of the Snake River in Wyoming. After your parents, your mother and father, divorced, your father stayed in California, your mother was in Wyoming with your stepdad. How did that experience, I mean, there were tough times, as you referred to, you were not wealthy, in fact, you were poor. And kids made fun of you, you know, because you lived in a trailer. How did the experience being close to nature, but poor, contribute to developing your resilience?
Yeah, you know, because of the experience of falling into the river and being chosen and having that experience of just feeling so deeply loved by the Snake River and by nature, I kind of saw myself as royalty in a way. And I thought of myself as river royalty. And I had a sense that that trumped any kind of financial treasures, you know, that there were, that I was part of something that was beyond that. And so, you know, it stung and it was painful to be shamed for. And it wasn't that we were necessarily poverty stricken. It was that we were lower middle class, working class in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, in a very robust tourist economy where, you know, I think there's been a book written about Jackson recently called Billionaire Wilderness. I mean, it's a place where there is a lot of wealth. And it's also a place that requires a very robust service industry to serve, you know, the people who are frequenting the valley. So my family was in the service industry. And, you know, as a result of that, there was this feeling that we were less than because we were servants, right? But I had this wild experience of later becoming a guide, also a part of the service industry. But that's what people are coming and paying for, is to, you know, kind of forge these relationships with nature or be in nature. And this was a field where I was an expert. And so that dynamic then is flipped, where the wealth is in the relationship with nature. And I always knew that from the beginning. And then that was proven to be true later when I became a guide.
Well put. This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Bridget Crocker about her memoir, River's Daughter. Now, at age 11, your mother underwent a sudden and drastic personality change. I mean, really sudden. What happened?
Well, I was 14, and it was on Easter Sunday, and my mom just came, you know, I describe it in the book, the chapter Easter Sunday. She just came out of her room a different person, had different values, you know, had different friends, wanted to change our lives drastically. And it was very confusing to me as a child. I couldn't figure out what was happening. It was like, you know, up was down and the light was dark, you know, everything had shifted. And it took me many, many years and stumbling upon a book about personality disorders to discover that this was the onset of a personality disorder and the symptoms that I described to you and that presented at that time are part of a personality disorder that is caused by childhood trauma that's untreated. So I really was very deliberate in writing this book and in talking about my mother's character and this sudden shift to really kind of couch it and show her as a woman in the context of her story. And that this was not a moral failing. This is mental illness, you know, and that the response that people have had to my mother's character has demonstrated to me how much further and how much more work we need to do to destigmatize mental illness, you know, because if my mother had come out of her room and had cancer, you know, there would be a lot more of compassion and understanding about that. So that's one of the things that I really am hoping to do with this story is to just kind of show using our story as an example of how do people, you know, navigate these sorts of illnesses.
I could relate to it a lot. I mean, my mother went through a lot of trauma in her childhood, and she also had a personality disorder that, you know, some of the things that your mother said to you and the crossing of boundaries was very familiar to me. And so I think that is important to destigmatize it, because I think especially women who have personality disorders are even more, I mean, you know, you can have a man who has malignant narcissism become the president of the United States, but a woman who was a malignant narcissist, I doubt would ever reach that point. But you ended up deciding to go live with your father, who also had, I think, is it right that he had a traumatic childhood as well?
Yes, they both came from very difficult backgrounds. And so that was part of what attracted them to each other, I think, is that they felt like home.
Yeah. And you went despite his history of violence. Why did you go to live with him? And what happened when you did?
So I went to live with my dad because, you know, the landscape around me completely shifted. And I didn't see a place for myself that was safe in my home anymore, which had been just such a wonderful, idyllic upbringing with my stepfather and my mom before my mother had this onset of the personality disorder. After that, it became very scary. And, you know, I did have this other card to play. I had, you know, a father who loved me very much, who had never abused me up to that point. And I had memories of him abusing my mom, but he had never, you know, and all that I would spend time with him. I visited him 3 times a year. At all the school breaks. And, you know, I never encountered anything like that during my times with him. So I decided to give that a try very quickly. Probably within the first couple of months, he started physically abusing me. And, you know, that became a different kind of hellscape to navigate. When I look back on that, and that's kind of the heart of why I wrote the book, was to just kind of delve back into that incredibly difficult period of my life from when I was 14 to 17, where a lot of things happened and that I needed to work out for myself and just kind of heal from and get clarity around.
Well, what was it like for you revisiting those memories while writing the book? What did you struggle with, or if anything?
I think it's really difficult. You know, number one, there's the first layer of you're writing about something that's incredibly triggering emotionally and difficult. And so I developed a practice where I would only, you know, go in for an hour at a time. So I would have I would wear a talisman for protection. And then I would set a timer for an hour and I would go in and write for just an hour, get the piece of the story that I needed and then come out. Because I saw that if I just sort of dwelled there, it would be very difficult for me to come out of. So that was one part of it. Another part was working with writers groups with other people. So I had support during that time working through these stories, not only just emotional support, but support in like writing about them in a way that connects with the reader, you know, because it's one thing for me to sort of vomit up my story, but that doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to connect with readers or be of service to readers. So there's different layers of writing about trauma was my experience. The first, the vomiting it up, right? And just getting it on the page, you know, the acknowledgement and the process of this happened to me in this way. And I also had this idea as I was doing that, this kind of knowledge that once it's out of me, once I purge the story out of me, it isn't going to take up real estate in my head anymore, in my spirit anymore. It will be on the page. And if I want to revisit, you know, the rape scene, I can read chapter 9, you know, I don't have to have it like banging around in my psyche all the time. So it was kind of like this big festering wound for a long time. And writing it helped to ease that festering. And so in that way, you know, it was cathartic. And then I also, you know, am involved in several 12-step programs, which provide tremendous support, as well as seeing therapists during that time and still. So just having that kind of support was really important for me.
That's a very telling point about the difference between vomiting something up, which you have to do to deal with it yourself, but then creating the bond with the reader. And I think you were very skillful at that. I can't say that I could put my finger on what the difference is, but you know the difference when somebody is just kind of venting versus bringing the reader along on a deeply personal story that creates meaning across the page and makes that connection. I wonder if there was any one clue in your own process that you could share with us in making that leap from the first stage to the second.
Yeah, and that is an important leap. And I don't think it was just one leap. I think it was a series of lily pads, you know, of just getting comfortable enough. Somebody asked me on tour recently, like, how do you get comfortable talking about the trauma? And I told, and she, you know, was weeping, and obviously the book had touched her in a way that she really needed that connection. And I said, you know, it's not that I'm comfortable with the trauma and talking about it. It's that I've become comfortable with the uncomfortability. So I think that's the lily pads I'm talking about, is that as you write about it and talk about it and process it with other people, with other readers, you know, beta readers in your group, the people with therapists, and start to refine it and look at the characters. You know, you realize you're developing characters and looking at the other things. Because I think you can sort of, when you're writing about trauma, be so myopic and just like, what's it like for me and how am I experiencing this? But as the writer, you kind of have to pull away from that and set the scene. You know, there's a scene, like one of the characters in the sexual assault scene is a Douglas fir tree, you know, that I develop a relationship with that provides comfort for me. And so like, I have to talk about the tree and where is it situated and where's the river and what's the river saying to me, and kind of be able to pull myself out of just the blinding pain of it. So it's the writing through that blinding pain is the first part, which is the hard part because it's scary. A lot of people have a lot of fear about that. And I certainly did, but having the support to go through it, I knew that, you know, we get through the pain section of the journey. And then once you have it on the page, then you start to heal a little bit and you can start to move it around, move the words around, move the sentences around, realize like, oh, is this really crucial to the story? No, we don't need it. You know, and start looking at it more with an editor's eye, with a writer's eye of developing the details. And then, you know, from there, I got comfortable with that. And then from there, getting comfortable with, you know, I think maybe the hardest part was just releasing it, right? Releasing it and being comfortable with, like, however people are going to respond to it is not my business anymore. Like, I've done my part as the writer. I've kept my contract with, you know, the higher source that wanted me to write this story. And so now the results aren't up to me. Like, I've done my part of the job. But being in a place where you can really release that, you know, I don't read the reviews of the book, that sort of thing, because it is so personal. To read things that are critical or condemning, I think would be damaging for me.
Right. And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Bridget Crocker about her terrific memoir, The River's Daughter. So now to the rivers. You became a river rafting guide. We're kind of skipping over a lot of stuff here. At the time that you began this, it was a very male field. It probably is still pretty male. But you faced a lot of sexism and resistance and, you know, just it was difficult. It was painful to read because I'm old enough to remember those days as well in different professions, going into professions where you were one of the only women and the kind of contempt that one faced on just a daily basis from men. So talk about that sexism and talk about how you dealt with it.
Well, what's interesting is that, you know, as I was writing this book and afterward, I realized that, you know, all of these worlds that are and themes that I touch on in the book of the dysfunctional family, you know, that includes abuse, of sexism in the river guiding community, of, you know, the incredible disparity in distribution of wealth in my hometown. And later when I go to Zambia, you know, the racism that I encounter under the repercussions of colonialism, right? That all of these things have to do with power and the structure of power, and who has it and how do we shift that power and redistribute it. So I think when I was in my early 20s, when I was writing about the sexism that I encountered, and it's about power. It's about not wanting to relinquish power. And at the time, I was very cognizant of, you know, women had made tremendous strides, you know, like in being able to go to college and, you know, being able to choose when they wanted to start a family and being able to kind of break the glass ceiling in some ways, in some jobs. I mean, it was never easy, but, you know, being able to become lawyers there was one pillar that really remained strong, and that was the pillar of physical strength. And so this job that required tremendous physical strength, having women in it in particular, really threatened the patriarchy in a way that maybe it was so much more pronounced. And I was very aware of that, like that I had to always present as being very physically strong, because that was the thing that was constantly in question. Are you strong enough to row this boat? Are you strong enough to lift, you know, all the heavy gear that is part of putting on a rafting trip? There's a lot of heavy lifting, and it was really about physical strength. And so I knew that I had no, in the way that a lot of women talk about, like, there's no room for error when you're breaking into a male-dominated field. There was no room for error when it came to physical strength for me. I had to be as strong as the men, and I had to have good runs. Like, I wasn't afforded a lot of room to have carnage on the river, right? And so that's where I really leaned into my relationship with rivers and being able to communicate with rivers. I could ask, you know, for safe passage, I could ask to be shown the line so that I could put my boat in the part of the river where I was going to have the most success, right? And that was something that really was a huge benefit to me in this field, was my relationship with rivers and being able to use that to my advantage in a way that, you know, if I just try to sort of muscle my way through, I may not have succeeded to the degree that I did.
So say more about this relationship to the river. Is it more like your connection that you feel is a way of talking to yourself, not the river literally talking to you, but you being able to derive strength and power from how you feel about the river? Or for example, as when you went down the Zambezi River, which is probably, you know, 10 times more difficult than the most difficult rapids that you would experience in the United States. You talk in the memoir, in The River's Daughter, about the god, now I don't know how to pronounce it.
Nyami Nyami.
Nyami Nyami, the god of the river, Nyami Nyami. And you mentioned that the voice was very different from that of the snake. It feels like you're really talking about a phenomenon that is real.
Yeah, it is real. And I get this question a lot. And I think that the question that people are really asking me when they ask this question is like, how can I hear the river? How can I tap into that? Which is part of why I wrote the book, because I wanted to show that this was available to people. It's available to everyone. And what it requires to strengthen this relationship with nature is, like I showed in the opening chapter of the book, being able to sit down without distraction and focus your energy meditatively on nature and to disappear into your surroundings. So today we're so focused on the phones and all the distractions in our world that it's very rare, you know, for somebody to set aside an hour or 2 hours or an afternoon to go sit by a river doing nothing. And this is where people who like to fish, this is what the attraction with fishing is, folks. It's not about the fish. It's about, you know, getting into this meditative state while you're focusing on nature. It starts to seep into you. Like there's a bending of boundaries between you and your surroundings. And so you start to become the river while you're there next to it. And so that's the answer to the question, is it real? It is if you invest time and energy into developing that connection.
I had to think about how, you know, certain countries, is it Bolivia, I think, or maybe Ecuador, but a move really that's international, that's global, to give rights to rivers.
Yeah, New Zealand has, rivers have personhood in New Zealand. I think recently also in Canada, there was a case that they have agency and rights in their own, you know, outside of being anthropomorphized by humans, right? They were here long before us and will be here long after us.
Yeah. And you mentioned before the racism that you encountered in Zambia. I mean, I was really shocked. I mean, beyond racism, it is old-timey 19th century colonial attitudes, where the whites talk about the native Zambians as being like children, the way white plantation owners talked about black slaves as being like children. I mean, right. I was really shocked at that, and that included Americans who went there and just kind of adopted it so easily, almost without question. Talk about those attitudes and, you know, how they, their persistence, how they endure. Why?
Well, I don't know that it's adopted by Americans so easily without question. I think that there's a lot of moral grappling when you have grown up in a different culture and then you're faced with this. But if you're going into a place where you have to work and get along professionally, and you know, Doris Lessing in her book, The Grass is Singing, writes about this beautifully, where, you know, you show up and you're prepared to treat people as equals, but the society that you're joining is, you're going up against it again and again. And so after a certain point, to be successful in your job, it's required that you just acquiesce, right? Which I absolutely refused to do. So I wasn't very successful in my job. I got fired spectacularly. But, you know, what was exciting, What the opportunity that came out of that for me was really doing a deep dive and looking at power structures and like, why was, you know, this such an institution? Why was it so unshakable? And the dehumanizing, you know, all these things that come with colonialism, like you have to dehumanize, you have to minimize, and especially in a place where you have white minority rule, you know, how are you going to subjugate people who can easily overtake you? It's such a psychological head game, right? You're just playing such a huge psychological head game on people at a large scale and feeding them this bill of goods to keep that kind of a system in place. So it's radical. Just infantilizing, you know, and minimizing. It's very similar to what I experienced as a woman guide going against the society of male guides. It's the minimizing. You're not strong enough. You're weak. You can't do this without us. You know, we're the rightful keepers of this. Because it just threatens the power structure so drastically that these sorts of things become overdeveloped.
So how have things changed, let's say, as in river guiding? Have you seen shifts in power here? And I would imagine you would have been part of those shifts if they happened.
Yeah, so in 2016, there was a lawsuit that was brought against the National Park Service by 13 very courageous women who had experienced, as part of there's scientific expeditions that go through the park that are run by the National Park Service. As part of that scientific crew, these women had experienced tremendous sexual harassment, and they were suing the Park Service for fostering a culture of sexual harassment. And, you know, when that came out, it was this, you know, sort of big announcement that this lawsuit was happening. And I read through the document. And I remember it vividly. I was sitting on my patio having lunch in Malibu, and I was reading the document, and immediately I was like, oh, something like that happened to me too, with each of the citations that, you know, like the instances that had happened. And so I started writing in the margins like, yeah, I had that happen on this river with this, you know, in that situation. And so the whole document, by the end of me reading it, was completely filled with Me Too's, right? Of me writing, yeah, that happened here. And I never even thought about that. And that happened here. And it was like this mess of highlighted stuff. And so then right after that happened, somebody contacted me, Jamie Moy. She's a freelance writer, but she was doing a piece for Men's Journal about, she wanted to break the story on sexual harassment in the commercial guiding industry in rafting. And she was curious if I had any stories. And I said, well, you know, funny you ask. I actually do have some stories that very closely mirror the stories that were in this document. And so we worked together to break that story in Men's Journal. And this was in 2016, which was, it's 2 years before the Me Too movement, the second wave of the Me Too movement in Hollywood. So it was just like, it was time, you know, it was time for all of us to stop carrying these stories and thinking that we were isolated and that they were ours to carry. And I remember thinking too, like at that time, I hadn't been commercial guiding for a while, and I'd worked at the highest levels in the industry, and I wasn't looking for a job. So I had nothing to lose. Like I could be somebody who could use my stories in this way. Right after that story came out, I also wrote an essay for Outside Magazine. And it was kind of a call to action essay, you know, imploring the rafting community. We're people who are outside the box thinkers. We're people who can see a line where there isn't one. And we can and should be the people who can lead us forward into a more equitable workplace in this way. And interestingly, after that essay, I received a message from the river ranger for the Bridger-Teton National Forest, where the Snake River is. And he had written me and said, I saw your essay, your call to action essay, and I was the ranger who was responsible for protecting you during the time that you're writing about. And I just want to know, what could I have done to help you during that time? Because, you know, that's my job. And I was, you know, initially I was like, well, first of all, I'm happy to know you exist. Like, knowing that you were there would have been great, you know. I had no sense that there was somebody I could report this to. At the time, I was 20 years old. So we started this conversation that went on for 6 months. And we're kind of back and forth of like, what would be great would be like a hotline, you know, an anonymous hotline where people could report. Because before that, I, you know, had to report sexual harassment to my managers or the owners who were fostering this culture and creating this culture, right? So you're reporting it, the abuse, to the abusers. And like, so there needs to be a third party. So we started coming up with this list. I also suggested, you know, we should have anti-sexual harassment training every season, you know, when we recertify for first aid and CPR every spring, we should also have anti-sexual harassment training. I'm married to a lifeguard. when I asked all of the women lifeguards, you know, like what they did about their sexual harassment problem, they really didn't have one. And I was shocked. And it turns out it's because they have anti-sexual harassment training every year and they have to recertify. So I was like, this is a key component. So we came up with this whole protocol and then we presented it at the River Management Society's annual conference to the National Park Service and all the folks who are charged with implementing protocols for federal rivers. And so this protocol that we came up with was adopted on all federal rivers. And so I had the great pleasure of speaking with a river guide who works in the Grand Canyon. And she said, yes, we have to do anti-sexual harassment training every season. And that it's so much different for her now as far as having the support. This experiences still happen because when you're the only woman on a crew of guys, that's what, you know, so I think what we need now is to just create and cultivate a place where more women feel comfortable working there. Because I had to, you know, so many people have asked me, like, why didn't you quit? Like, why would you endure that kind of treatment? And, you know, everyone else that all the women that I started guiding with, all of them quit. I was the last one standing. And it was because of this sense of entitlement, this I'm river royalty and you're not going to kick me off my river, you know, and just being very stubborn and determined that I refused to let that push me out. And I was always very concerned with changing the culture. I was going to change the culture instead of just abandon it and leave. You know, I always saw it as like my job to do that. So that's what writing this book is a part of that as well.
Oh, that's great. I have one last question. You mentioned the Grand Canyon, and I had the great fortune of rafting down the Grand Canyon. This was in 1997, I believe, and it was my first, it wasn't my first rafting trip, but it was the first serious rafting trip. And my question is really about fear, because, you know, I had been told about the Hermit Rapid, and I knew I was going to go out before I got to Lava Falls, which is like the biggest, but Hermit is pretty big also. And I spent the days before we reached the Hermit Rapid, the nights really, unable to sleep, just terrified, just thinking, wow, you know, I could die. It was the greatest physical danger that I ever consciously anticipated in my life. You know, when you get into physical danger, usually you didn't expect it to happen, but this was days of expectation. How did you deal with the fear, if you had it? I mean, even if you were the queen of the river, you risked your life day after day.
I love this question. Thank you for asking it. So, yes, I have the fear. And I've come to realize that fear and adrenaline feel the same in our bodies. And so when I can make that shift in my mind that this isn't necessarily fear, this is adrenaline, which is a tool to help me do supernatural and superhuman things. The other thing is, the other practice, I have this saying, like, never drink coffee on lava day, right? Because you already have so much adrenaline going, you don't need coffee, you know, and that just makes you like over the top. So along with that is the like constant, you know, kind of bringing it into the here and now. So it's a Zen practice, right? Of like, right, like I'm not running lava right now. Right now, I'm just making breakfast. Right now, I'm just stuffing my sleeping bag. And so you actually, you know, kind of trick yourself into like, you're not at lava till you're at lava. And then, you know, right now, I'm just scouting lava. Right now, I'm just getting in the boat. Right now, I'm just pushing off. And then once you're in lava, you know, it's very quick. I mean, it's like a 30-second thing. And, you know, you kind of line up and you drop in and the results are not really up to you after that. So it's a huge practice in acceptance and, again, becoming comfortable in the uncomfortability, right, of that. And I think I had a head start in that area because I came from a family and a background where, you know, I was very comfortable in chaos. So that kind of felt like home to me starting out, but there is the fear component. And I remember, you know, really kind of having to coax myself through that. And so that's kind of my process of how I do it.
Oh, I'm so glad I asked that question. Great answer. Well, Bridget Crocker, as I said before, I thoroughly love this book, your memoir, River's Daughter, and I love this conversation. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure to be here, and thanks for all your great questions.
Go to writersvoice.net for a link to photos of Bridget Crocker leading river trips. Next up, we play an excerpt from our March interview with Cassidy Randall about her book 30 Below. It's about the six women mountaineers who made the first all-female ascent of Denali. Stay tuned after the break. That was Shamikia Copeland in Blame It on Eve. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. Last March, we spoke with Cassidy Randall about her book, 30 Below, wherein she tells the story of the first all-women's team to summit Denali in 1970. Facing deadly storms, exhaustion, and a mountaineering culture that dismissed their abilities, the climbers proved not only their strength, but also redefined what was possible for women in the sport. Let's listen to an extended excerpt from that conversation now. Cassidy Randall, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Wow, what a gripping account this book, 30 Below, was. The harrowing and heroic story of the first all-women's ascent of Denali. So this happened in 1970. Denali is the highest point in North America. It's an incredible story featuring amazing characters, women who were strong, had fantastic endurance, obsessive commitment, maybe even a little craziness given the fantastically dangerous conditions they subjected themselves to. So first, tell us about the mountain, Denali. What were the conditions? What are the conditions that people face if they try to reach the peak?
So Denali scrapes the sky at over 20,000 feet. And while it's not the tallest mountain on Earth, you know, it's not as tall as the 7,000 and 8,000 meter peaks in the Himalaya. It is one of the biggest mountains on Earth. So because it rises from a plateau on the Alaskan tundra that sits at just 2,000 feet, means that Denali rises 18,000 feet from its base, which is 6,000 more feet than Everest rises from its base. And so what that means is that climbers have to be on the mountain for longer to acclimatize to that incredible altitude gain, which means that they have to go slowly so that their bodies can get used to less oxygen in the air the further you grow up. And what that also means is being on the mountain for longer subjects them to these wild weather patterns that hit Denali that are unique to where it sits. So because it's the highest polar mountain and it sits close to the coast, it gets hit with these quicksilver fast, bitingly cold storms out of nowhere. And it is constantly cold on top of the mountain, just absolutely freezing temperatures, you know, 20 to 40 degrees below, winds of more than 70 miles an hour on a regular basis. And because it sits so far north on the 63rd parallel, while it's not as high as Everest, that location means that its air is just as thin as Everest in terms of where the oxygen is. So not an easy mountain to climb.
No, it is not. In fact, the mountain has claimed over 100 lives since 1903. And there was a particularly notable tragedy in 1967, which you kind of begin the book with, because one of the main characters in your book, Grace Homan, basically was on the mountain when that happened. So what did happen?
That 1967 incident is still the single biggest tragedy to have ever hit Denali at the time of my writing of this book. So in 1967, Grace Homan, an Alaskan mountaineer and doctor, was the only woman on an expedition heading for the summit of Denali. And they were little more than midway up the mountain when this storm broke over the top and it trapped them in their camp where they were midway up the mountain. And when the storm had lifted just enough, they saw these figures coming down the mountain. And it was part of this party, the Wilcox expedition, who they knew were ahead of them on the mountain. And they go up and they meet this distressed party. And Joe Wilcox, who was the leader, said, "We have members of our party up on the top who stayed on top to summit. We haven't heard from them. They're seven men. We haven't heard from them for days. We had to descend because we were in such poor health from being up there for so long." And Grace was a member of the Alaska Rescue Group, as were some other members of the expedition that she was on. And Grace, unfortunately, was turned back in this crux moment that ends up being some really heavy stakes for her wanting to lead this all-women's expedition later. She's turned back. The rest of that expedition goes up after the storm has lifted to find that all seven men have died. And this storm was so intense that winds were estimated at 300 miles an hour on the summit. And that is not a typo.
It's incredible. I mean, that's like 100 miles more than a Category 5 hurricane.
It's sort of impossible to imagine what that would have been like.
Yeah, so you mentioned that this had something to do with her plans to lead an all-women's ascent of Denali. First, talk about the conditions that faced women in this very, very male sport at the time.
I love this question because I have so many outrageous anecdotes about what women used to face in the mountains. But first, context is so important here because this was 1970. And by then, we had sent men to the moon and women had not stood on the highest points on Earth, which is amazing. If this wasn't that long ago, right? It's fairly modern history. But at the time, popular belief held that women were incapable of doing this without men's help. They couldn't withstand high altitudes or savage elements or carrying heavy loads. They were too physically and emotionally weak to handle all that. So there are just some wild anecdotes. Like, for example, in 1961, which was just 9 years before Grace Holman led this climb, Irene Miller, who was an accomplished American alpinist, went to Makalu Base Camp in the Himalaya with her husband, who was on Sir Edmund Hillary's expedition up that mountain, hoping to join the expedition. Again, she's an accomplished alpinist. Hillary not only forbids her from the expedition, one of the members of his team says that if she wants to join, she ought to be willing to sleep with all the men on the team, as in have sex with. And remember, she went to base camp with her husband. So it wasn't just these narratives of the fact that women were weaker. Anytime a woman failed in the mountains on a high profile climb, it was just more evidence that they were incapable of doing this. It was these other sexist barriers that existed.
Exactly. Now, there was another reason why Grace wanted to summit Denali, and that had something to do with losing the love of her life. Is that right?
Yes. So not only before she leads this 1970 expedition, in the 3 years essentially leading up to this 1970 expedition, she is turned back on two expeditions on Denali, and then she wants to join an expedition to Dalagiri 1 in the Himalaya, which is, at the time, was widely considered the hardest 8,000-meter peak to climb. And her husband, Vin Holman, who was a really well-known Alaskan mountaineer, was on that expedition. The leader of that expedition had asked Vin to help him find qualified team members. Vin puts Grace forward because she's incredibly qualified, has climbed all over the world, has soloed several first ascents, and she's a doctor, which is really useful on these expeditions. And the team leader, though, writes back and says Grace must be suffering from illusions of grandeur and light experience and refuses to allow her. And then, heartbreakingly, Vin never comes back from the Himalaya. He dies on an avalanche on the mountain. And Grace is just laden with what becomes this really intense and metastasizing survivor's guilt and thinking, what if I had been there? Could I have made different decisions where he wouldn't have died? What if women had been on the expedition at all? Would different decisions be made? Which leads her, all of these factors, to say, what if an all-women's team climbed a mountain? What would happen?
Let's talk about, you know, I said before, they may have a little bit of craziness. For me, It is unimaginable to put myself in the kind of risk and extreme discomfort that you describe so vividly in this book, Cassidy Randall, In 30 Below. Talk about the psychology of mountain climbers. And there's even a scientific basis for people who do this. Tell us what that is.
I love talking about this. And I have a little imposter syndrome because I'm not an alpinist. I did not climb Denali for this book. I have done some high altitude pursuits, and I know my body does not do well at altitude. But I am a backcountry skier. I dabble in ski mountaineering and a lot of other mountain pursuits. And so I've been interested in this for a while. Why do we do this? And there is a few scientific studies that have isolated this gene called DRD4, and it's associated with explorers. It's called the explorer gene. So people who seek novelty, who want to try new things, who want to go to far-flung locations. So partially it's science. But a lot of people who do the things like this team of women did will tell you that it's not science, that there's something more ephemeral to it, that there is this meditation in having the simplicity of all you have to do every day is move upward, keep yourself alive, and have the single goal. And there's such an ultimate presence to that, that people meditate for hours, lifetimes to achieve, right? And you can achieve it just by being on the side of this mountain and everything that goes with that, of course. And there is also this presence in being sort of at the hands of the elements, where there's so much risk involved, where what keeps you safe is your own capability and your knowledge of conditions, and sometimes some unpredictable elements too, right? You can't control everything out there. And that sort of proximity to the natural world and how volatile it can be also is this ultimate presence. And people who have walked this line, and even people who, you know, you go out to do some things that don't involve quite, you know, the risk of dying, but still there might be some sort of physical risk involved. And if you're just so close to the natural world, where there's this awe, this self-transcending awe, so many studies that talk about what awe does for us, that even though you are so close to death, like these women were at times, it's the most alive that you ever feel.
Mm. Well, I must have a home buddy gene.
Which is also very valuable.
Yeah. But it was just an incredible account to read. So now tell us about the other women as well. I mean, that first expedition that we spoke about where those seven climbers died, part of the reason was a social breakdown in the group. So social relationships are absolutely key in this expedition, and also key to creating some danger within it. So first tell us about these women, the other women there is, apart from Grace Homan, Margaret Young, Dana Isherwood, Arlene Blum, Margaret Clark, and Faye Kerr. And they called themselves the Denali Damsels. So start right there.
I do love that these were all really accomplished mountaineers, women who had a lot of experience. And if they didn't have a lot of experience, they substituted quite a lot of strength with it. And they chose this name, the Denali Damsels, for the irony of it. And so they're stationary on, you know, where they would sort of send that out to get sponsors and on their applications to the park. Their official name was the International McKinley Women's Team. And then in this cursive underneath, it said Denali Damsels. And there's this great correspondence between Arlene and Grace, this letter correspondence, where Arlene writes that Margaret Young came up with this name and Arlene loved it because it conjured this image of just walking daintily up this savage mountain with parasols, right? And Grace reads it and laughs out loud. And they choose to use this name. And I think that that's kind of a testament to who these women were, that they were trying to do something that everybody thought was impossible and had the ability to kind of laugh about it. I mean, that's pretty impressive. But one thing that drew me to this narrative was that these women were all so different, very different, all the way from age. You know, Grace was 44, 45 when she led this expedition. Arlene was 23, 24. And from geography, Faye was Australian. Margaret Clark was from New Zealand. They were from Alaska and California. But what was really interesting and sort of a uniting factor was that they were these women who were really used to navigating men's worlds already, and not just as rare female climbers, but they were doctors, chemists, physicists, geologists, pilots, mechanics, which is really amazing in 1970. And what I also love about this is that in terms of social dynamics, they knew that they would be subject to scrutiny as sort of the first all women's team to do this, right? And that although social dynamics had broken apart the Wilcox expedition, that was that fated expedition in 1967 on Denali, where those seven men died, the Wilcox expedition had been excoriated for its social dynamics that led to that tragedy. And the women were pretty aware that they would be sort of excoriated for catfights, right? So it could be the least little thing, and it would be blown up. Whatever, you know, failure perceived or real would really be magnified. And the social dynamics then that are really interesting is that these women, none of them follow this typical hero's journey that we like to associate with our cultural narratives, right? There's no clear-cut saints and sinners. They don't all emerge friends at the end the way that we want, you know, or the companions in our great tales to emerge. And that has to be okay because they are real and complicated people.
This amazing ascent of the real first woman ascent of Denali that happened in 1970, you say did have a profound legacy. What was that?
I think we're even still seeing what that legacy was. And in the sort of immediate spheres, there were local newspapers that covered this in the Bay Area, where several of the women were from, and Anchorage. Margaret Clark wrote some pieces in the Christchurch Press about it right off the bat. And so these women were influencing their close personal spheres, even if it didn't make national news, right? That they were just matter-of-factly doing these things that people thought were impossible for women to do. And in that, you know, directly, they were also training the next generation of climbers. And so Margaret Young really taught Annie Whitehouse to climb, who was one of the first women on Everest, American women on Everest. Margaret Clark had some influence with Lydia Brady, who was the New Zealand climber who in the 1980s became the first woman at all to summit Everest without oxygen. And so now Arlene, who has just an incredible resume in mountaineering and alpinism, is probably one of the biggest influences on the women's climbing world in modern history. So that climb for her cut her teeth on leadership, right? And a few years later, she would go on to lead the first all women's climb to Annapurna in the Himalaya, which is a wildly savage mountain. And she wrote about that as well. So I think that sometimes it takes us a while to see the bigger impact, but immediately these women had an impact on their communities right off the bat.
And that was Cassidy Randall talking with us in March 2025 about her book, 30 Below. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.